You're listening
to the CD Baby.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
DIY.
Musician.
Musician. Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the 57th episode of the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast. My name is Kevin Bruner, you're a host for the show, and on this edition of the podcast, you're going to hear from Matt Malley, the former bass player for the Counting Crows. Matt was with the Counting Crows back when they were still just an indie band up in Northern California, and of course, we all know that they made it big with a string of hit songs and platinum albums. But at the end of 2004, Matt decided to move on to other pursuits and is now back in the world of indie music with a solo album on CD Baby. In our conversation, we cover everything from how the Counting Crows got started, the inner workings of their band as a business, some of their mistake stories, and what it's like to start over as an indie artist after having so much success. So let's get to my interview with Matt Malley. Matt, thanks for being on the podcast. As you know, we mentioned a few episodes back about how the Counting Crows had decided to leave their label, and it was great to find out that you were in our podcast listening audience and have a CD on CD Baby.
Yeah, it's exciting. Exciting times.
Before we get into some of those current events, how did you end up in the Counting Crows in the first place?
Well, we formed back in 1990 up in Berkeley, and so we're all Northern California, you know, people. We grew up there. And I was in a previous band with a guy named Dave Bryson, who ended up being Adam Duritz's kind of partner, songwriting partner or whatever, and those two put together Counting Crows. So they were doing an acoustic duo sort of thing around the Bay Area, and they decided to put a whole band together. So Dave recommended me as a bass player, so he brought me in, and Adam is a big Fairport Convention fan, and so was I, so we automatically kind of bonded over British Isle folk rock.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of how I got the gig, you could say.
So when you started out with the Counting Crows, it was still just in process. It wasn't to the point of having label interest or anything like that.
No. I got to see the whole thing unfold. You know, when I joined, we did a really big demo tape. It was like a double album demo back then, of like 15 or 16 songs, and ended up in the hands of some lawyer, a music lawyer in L.A., who finally passed it to a record label, and it went around all around the, I think there were 9 or 10 major labels, and our demo was flying around all of them, so they all came and watched us play at one point. And it was kind of like a fairy tale like that. We played there was something called the Gavin Convention, and we played that up there in the Bay Area. And all I think there were 9 labels, and all 9 labels came to see Counting Crows, and all 9 labels offered us a record deal the next day.
Well, that's nice. Were you surprised by that acceptance and you know, the industry embracing you so quickly like that?
Yeah, it was a shock, because we were in our late 20s by then. I was 28. And so we had been trying for, you know, at least 10 years in different bands and, you know, trying to make something happen. I think the key is a great front man, because Adam was he's a great songwriter and he's a really good performer. And a label, you know, back when labels were important, labels wanted you to be able to tour your album. So making a great record was only one side of the coin. They wanted to make sure you were a great live band as well. Because that's how you sell your records. You have to get out there on the road and grind it out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not everybody can be the Beatles and, you know, retire and just go to the studio and make your best albums.
Yeah.
You know, you got to go slog it out on the road.
So when the album released and Mr. Jones just took off, were you surprised by that success? Or at that point, did you kind of feel that there was something special about what you guys were doing?
Yeah. You know, it felt really weird. We were out touring, so touring it was such a grind at the time. We were touring in a van that was pulling a trailer with our equipment, and then Adam's father's car. He had a Toyota Camry, so we had a crew of three. We were working really hard when Mr. Jones hit, and we even had shot the video for it, so it was on MTV. And what was really my feeling of seeing us on MTV in a hotel room, I was always shocked when we'd come on. I would think, well, that's just us. What are we doing there?
Yeah.
That's just me and the guys, you know, that's not normal. We don't belong there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you know, even, you know, the Mr. Jones video was so popular, it just didn't seem like it belonged there because I knew everybody.
That was just you and your friends that just happened to be in between all these famous acts.
Exactly, yes. Well put. Yeah. Yeah.
Did that change for you as the band continued to grow in popularity, and did it start to feel more normal?
Well, it always felt like it was happening outside of our bubble. Like you're so hard at work that it was basically when I'd get on the phone, like I didn't even have a cell phone, you know, back like in the early 90s, where, you know, you'd get on the hotel phone and call on your hotel on a AT&T card, you know, mm-hmm. you might remember.
Oh, yes.
And, yeah, you've done bringing your phone, I know. So, yeah.
Yes.
And so I'd call the parents and, you know, and just, you know, blab with my friends on the phone, like my best buddy. And I would hear from them what it felt like, you know, to be sitting back in their lives and hearing about everything that's happening to us. Because when you're out there working, it's just night after night is a show, and, you know, every evening is a hotel room, and every day is a long drive. And to gauge what was happening, I'd have to call my friends at home.
That's a very interesting perspective that I felt the same way as well. And it's interesting to hear you say that too. How did you guys go about writing songs and arranging songs as a group? Was you mentioned Adam being a great songwriter. Did he do most of the songwriting and then bring it to you guys for the arranging part, or how'd that work?
Yeah, Adam wrote like 90% of everything Count and Close related. So he'd come in, most of the time he'd come in and bang out something on the piano, and you could hear the whole band in his piano. And so then, you know, basically we just start grooving with them and then we'd have to, I mean, it's easy to just strum along to a song and play the chords, but then you have to do something interesting with it and make it something unique. So after that, we'd fine tune our parts, but he'd have the lion's share already written, you know, and then the smaller percentage of songs got written maybe at a jam and sound check, or maybe a band member would bring in some chords. And Adam would, if he dug it, he would start singing something over it, and, you know, but most of it is really his stuff.
When you guys were working on tracks, I mean, how did you know when you had the final product, when the song was where it needed to be? Were you guys a band that spent a lot of time revising, or was it something where it's like some magic happened here, we're going to use this, and if it doesn't happen, we're going to move on?
Yeah, no, we were workaholics, you know. We'd take a year to make a record,
mm-hmm.
you know. So, a lot of that was the producer. You know, the producer would put up the flag and say, "You're done. That's the take."
Uh-huh.
You know, and by done, that would really be mean the drum take is done. You know, and then a lot of us would go in and overdub or redo things and. You know, but we'd edit a lot of stuff too, including drums.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there'd be a lot of tape on the floor, the cutting room floor, as they say. But once we had the drum take, we knew we were ready to start overdubbing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, but we'd play live as a band to get our drummer dialed in.
Mm-hmm. So when you guys were in the studio, were you there for months on end? I'm guessing that the process changed a bit after the first album was such a big hit.
Yeah, it kind of remained the same in that we would rent a house and record our records in a house. That's how we did the first record.
Mm-hmm.
The first producer that did us was a guy named T-Bone Burnett,
mm-hmm.
who's a great, great producer, my favorite producer by far. And he made us all better musicians doing that first record with us, the August and Everything After record. And he told us to rent a house. You know, the way he put it is that recording studios reek of despair. So you guys want to be in a house for, if you're going to be spending months going to work, just bring a recording studio into a house. So we did that.
Mm-hmm.
And he compared it to the band, that they had done music from Big Pink in a house, and that's just the way to do it. So that basically set a trend. So every record we did, we would rent a house, and that's how we lasted. That's how we could go to work for a year and record an album.
So were you all living in that house, or was it just a place where it was, you know, like going to the office, but not in a studio that can feel cold or have no
right.
vibe?
Well, yeah, well, the guys that lived out of town would live in the house.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the people who lived in the L.A. area, which was me at the time and Adam, well, the first record, we all lived in Northern California, so, you know, we all lived in that house when we made the first record.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, the second one was getting started. Only a couple of us lived in L.A., so the rest of the band would live in that house. And it was a good-sized house, you know, very comfortable and stuff. And, you know, usually a detached second house would have the recording area
mm-hmm.
there.
So were you guys recording just 2-inch tape or digital tape, or how were you doing that?
We didn't do digital until our third record. So our August and everything after, and then the second one was Recovering the Satellites. That was done on tape. Although I remember a little bit of drum edits were done with Pro Tools at the time. This was made in 94,
mm-hmm.
or no, 95, I believe, we recovered Recovering the Satellite. And we were also amazed that he could move the snare around. We couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
And now it's like that's laughable, that editing is so fundamental.
Yeah.
But we were all amazed at the time.
How did the success of the band, did it change a lot of the interpersonal dynamics, or it seems like you guys are all good friends?
Yeah, we were all good friends, and we remain good friends,
mm-hmm.
you know. No, it didn't. There was a year of adjustment when Adam was really the rock star,
mm-hmm.
and the rest of us were kind of replaceable, and there was kind of a year of people kind of trying to find their boundaries and pushing for attention, and then realizing, well, it's about Adam and we have to just face that. And we just stood in we finally found our ground. And it also dawned on us, or not dawned on us, but it was, we learned that other bands were very similar, and that when you're a musician, you usually know the name of everyone in your favorite band.
Mm-hmm.
But the general public, for you too, for example, I was told by our tour manager, who was big, he was in U2's camp up to the Joshua Tree tour. He's a guy named Tom Mullally, and he's Counting Crows tour manager. He told me that they would go to after show parties or whatever, like on their Unforgettable Fire tour, and Edge at one point was signing an autograph for a fan, and Bono walked in the room, and the fan actually took the autograph unfinished out of Edge's hand and ran over to Bono. and for you or me or any musician, we're like, well, that was Edge, man. What are you
doing?
That's the way the general public looks at their favorite bands. It's all about the singer.
Yeah.
You know? And so there was a year or so when we were kind of like getting a little bummed out, but then it just sort of started to reveal itself that this is kind of normal,
mm-hmm.
you know? And we found our ground with that. And the hardcore fans actually knew all of us. So,
yeah.
You know, our egos got stroked where they needed to be.
What? How did you deal with that? I mean, I know that for some people, it's even the indie artist, in fact, it may hit the indie artist a lot more than they are ever expecting, that once they start to play and see some a little success, that suddenly there's this sort of jockeying for position of who is this band going to be about. And sometimes, you know, it can be equal ground, and sometimes there's personalities where, it, like you're saying, it is about the lead singer. How did you guys deal with that?
It was a little hard at first. It was, some people dealt with it harder than others, you know. I wasn't one of them, fortunately, and I don't want to say who it was, but one band member said, we started off as the Beatles and turned into Elvis.
<That's>...
I thought that was a good way to put it, but he was a little more on the resentful side. But the rest of it, I mean, we knew what was happening.
Yeah.
We knew it was obvious, and we also knew that Adam's he's a charismatic performer, and not all of us were, And that was something we realized, well, we're lucky we have the job we have.
Yeah.
And there's just a point when you just kind of go with it, you know. But again, it wasn't easy because you grow up thinking that all your heroes are like, they're all equal, they're all best friends. And it's not the case, you know. Not the case at all. You know, Led Zeppelin, you know, Robert Plant and Jimmy Page were in the front, while the other two were ignored, basically.
Yeah.
But to me, they're all four gods, you know, up there in the sky.
Yeah.
You know, like, on equal ground, you know.
We always talk about it a lot on the podcast about mistakes artists make. And I'm curious if there's any mistakes that stand out in your mind that even with all the success that you guys had, if there are things and you look back, you go, I wish we hadn't done this, or that was a bonehead idea, or are there anything that stands out to you like that?
Ah, good question. Let me think here for a second. You know, there was a business move that Adam did that we didn't know about till years later, which was a big fumble, but it involves money, you know, which kind of, you know, it's for the artistic mind, you know, selling out isn't the greatest thing, but we were told years later that we could have bought out our contract when August and everything after became so successful. We could have bought out the rest of we were signed at six records, I think, on Geffen.
Yeah.
We could have bought out our contract and renegotiated for millions and millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And Adam didn't want to do it, and I still don't know why. I think he looked at it as selling out or whatever, you know, which is a little strange because he's making like 10 times more publishing money than the rest of the band.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so he's saying, I don't need that extra money. And we were told years later, and we're like, oh, what were you thinking, dude? You know? I mean, it's purely business, you know, and it's funny, and I'm a little embarrassed because I'm like the spiritual type, and I'm an artist, and that's just money right now. But you could say that was a bad idea.
Yeah, yeah. Well, with the band I was in, we signed a contract that was, you know, for one album with the option of, I think, like six more. And your mindset is that, well, I want that guarantee of six albums, and you're not thinking that that's not a guarantee. That's basically they're owning our rights for those albums, and they can refuse anything. They don't have to do anything.
Yeah.
And I think that's partly, you know, it feels somewhat secure to have a deal where you feel like there's a guarantee, but there really isn't.
Yeah, there you go. You know, yeah, it's very insightful that you know that, you know. It's nice to watch the labels crumble and burn in slow motion here because they don't believe it's happening yet.
Yeah.
You know, but it's like Rome burning or something, you know. They're trying to ignore it. And meanwhile, it's like karma, you know. We were signed at 80%. The label took 80%, and we took 20, and that was a historic, generous deal.
Yeah, that is good.
Yeah, it was really good. But it's, you think about it, it's like they're taking 80%. You know, of course we needed them, but that doesn't mean they can take 80%.
Yeah.
You know? So the whole thing was crooked, and it's fun to watch them go down.
You touched on it briefly just a second ago about, you know, Adam making a business decision and you guys not knowing about it. How was Counting Crows set up as a band? On the podcast, we've talked about like taxes on an episode previously, and we plan to talk about setting up a band as a business in future episodes. But how did you guys have it set up?
You mean like who's the in charge?
Who's the, like, as far as the actual, like, partnership, was it, and who owned the business of Counting Crows? Was it equal? Was it Adam having a much larger chunk of say in business decisions, or was it just his alone, or how did that work?
Good point. It was all Adam, although we were all partners, but Adam owned the Counting Crows name, and mm-hmm. He could basically fire anybody without a reason.
Okay.
You know, that was part of the contract. But again, we all made equal royalties right down the middle.
Mm-hmm.
Adam made a lot more in songwriting.
Yeah.
But he would share, you know, whenever we would get in on other songs and stuff, we'd get our names on it and get, which that the Shrek 2 song was a lucky one for me because I got that Oscar nomination for. That's another subject, but it was we were set up where Adam was really the guy in charge. He owned the name, and that was it. And everyone else was kind of equal under him.
Did that seem to work well for you guys as far as like when decisions were made that everyone basically were able to live with it?
Well, only because Adam, he made some smart decisions. We had a lot of success, so no one complained. But if he would have, you know, wanted us to something Spinal Tap, you know, or go open for a puppet show or something on TV, he could have dragged us into that and we would have had no say.
Yeah. You know? So,
thankfully, he had a little bit of discretion when it comes to making cool decisions and trying to be cool.
Yeah. You know?
So we were lucky there, but it was really nothing was in our control. It was all in his.
Yeah. You mentioned a business mistake. Were there any, looking back, any things where you thought musically you wish that hadn't happened?
Yeah. Well, as a songwriter, I'm a big fan of old Adam. You know, that's why I was his bass player. You know, I think he's a great songwriter.
Mm-hmm.
He had some spikes that kind of bring the chart way down. You know, on a couple of songwriting things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like lyrically. There's a song, American Girls, you know, he says, come into bed so edible.
Mm-hmm.
On stage, I would always cringe, you know, when we got to that line. Nothing against, you know, free love and all that. I mean, it's not like I'm religious, but it's like I like a more universal lyric. You know?
Yeah.
I like, you know, come into bed so edible. It's like really funneling it down into one little thing. You know, and the timing of that, sadly, was right after September 11th, the 2001 World Trade Center. And so here we are, like, you know, when all this is happening and we're all on stage, come into bed, so edible. And it felt so shallow,
mm-hmm.
you know. So there was a time there, spiritually speaking, when it was really embarrassing
mm-hmm.
to be playing a couple of songs. There's like two or three, not many. You know.
But I think it's interesting to hear you say that, because I think some people tend to, you know, have a hard time with the compromise that it takes in order to be in a band, and maybe at a successful level as well, that there's probably not the perfect situation where
yeah.
everything you're doing, you're like, yes, I'm 100% behind this.
Yeah, exactly. Unless it's you, unless you're the party, you know, if you're somebody's bass player or somebody's drummer, they're probably going to be doing stuff that's going to embarrass you at some point.
Yeah.
So, yeah, which is why being an independent musician is so fulfilling. It's like flying your own F-18.
Yeah.
You know, instead of being one of the Beverly Hillbillies in this old jalopy or something, you know, you're flying your own jet now. You know.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, you know, you are pursuing music independently now. What was one of the main reasons that you decided to leave Counting Crows? And
mostly my family. I have two little boys, and I missed the first one's first 4 years of his life. When you're in a touring band, you're living in hotel rooms. You know this, and so I heard things like he said, "I love you" the first time, and I was in a hotel room in Amsterdam. You know.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so the second one came along, and during that first year, it was in 04, it got to be around October, November. He was born in January of 04, and it was October of 04, and I realized, oh my God, I'm a missing in action dad for the second one now. So
mm-hmm.
I quit them in December. I just left them and haven't looked back, actually.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're still friends, and I'm even on one song on their new record, but you know, I'm so glad. I haven't even doubted once that, you know, I mean, money-wise, the money was good, and we're kind of burning through our savings right now, and you know, but I'm not 80. I can still get a job,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not missing my boys growing up. So that's what did it.
Yeah, we had some experiences like that. I didn't have a child at the time, but one of our, when we were touring, one of our members did, and it became a part of his decision to leave the band as well. And
that's, interesting.
Yeah, it's very, very tough. He actually burst out crying in the studio one day in front of everybody just because of the pressures became so great and, you know, not being home. So
I can relate.
Did you find it easier? Did you feel that like the Counting Crows had maybe peaked and things were just going to kind of cruise at that level for a while, and so it was easier to leave, or what are your thoughts on where they're at now in their career?
Yeah, that also made it a little easier, honestly. I mean, we had our success on our first two records, you know, especially the first one.
Mm-hmm.
And if that was the only record we ever made, I'd probably be equally as proud of our catalog. You know, I think that's just a great record, and And then the second one came along, and it did pretty well, but it was a downhill ride after that.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, you know, it made it easier. If we had kept our level, you know, of success, I would have thought twice about leaving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because starting to, you know, we'd have some dry years, you know, and here I am, I got a family to support, so I got to start thinking of a way to make a little income, you know, and that's had a lot to do with it. That I'm not doing it right away, but I'm reinventing myself,
yeah.
You know, as a supporter of my family, a dad that's going to support his family. It doesn't even need to be music,
yeah.
You know. Anyway, so that was something to do with it.
Yeah.
The dry years had a little bit to do with
it. Now that you're an indie artist and you have an album up on CD Baby, how do you go about pursuing music now that it's just back down to you? You don't have that giant machine behind you anymore, or, you know, you're not a member of the Counting Crows for your individual stuff. How do you do this?
Yeah, it's I'll tell you, I'm learning as I go here, but it's really exciting. It's exciting to have the last say in everything. It's exciting to be the artist.
Yeah.
You know, that's the first payoff, the first big reward is, you know, I got to oversee all the artwork on my record. I printed it through oasis.com. And they did this awesome job of the printing. I recorded myself in my own home studio. I was the guy. It was all about me,
mm-hmm.
You know. So I wasn't a passenger,
yeah.
on someone else's airplane. And even all the big machinery of record labels and all the backing and your distributors and automatic everything. It felt like I didn't have my hands in it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Even though the record sales were way bigger and all that, it just never felt like I was part of it. I felt like I just had to worry about the bass parts and show up for work and then get paid.
Yeah.
You know, and when you're an artist, you can't just do that. You know, you gotta be the creator of the art sometimes. You know?
Yeah.
And so being an independent now, that I'm having my first taste of my first taste of success is fulfillment as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if a record sells a lot someday, I'll be thrilled, you know, but the first success is actually making a product that I believe in, you know, that I really believe in.
Well, I'm glad you put it that way, because so many artists that I talk to, all their success and idea of success is wrapped up in the end of the day, how many people bought it. And to me, a lot of times it's like you, when you're going through the process of recording and you just put so much of yourself into that recording. And then when you're done, it's just kind of, to me, like you're saying, success one that you sit back and listen to and go, wow, I stretched myself. I'm proud of myself. That's a good effort.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, you're the artist, but you're also the audience. You know, you're your first audience.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So that audience has to really believe in what you did.
You mentioned a little ways back the Oscar nomination for Shrek. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Shrek 2. We did the opening song for Shrek 2. It was called Accidentally in Love, big hit. And I got in on the songwriting of that, which was really exciting. That was one of those cases where Adam kind of was open to suggestions. And, you know, so we all met in a hotel room. Actually, five of us were in a hotel room and all wrote that song together with, mm-hmm. Adam. And he actually credited a couple of the other guys for the Oscars, because they were so bummed out that they didn't get Oscar nominations. So even though their names aren't on the songwriting, they all got their Oscar nominations, you know. And
mm-hmm.
One of them was Charlie, the keyboard player. He had a little boy, so Charlie wanted his little boy to be proud,
mm-hmm.
you know. So Adam, being very generous, you know, gave a couple of guys their nomination. But that was an exciting time, and it was because we got in on the songwriting. So, you know, when you're in a band with a songwriter, it really will help you be fulfilled to know that you have a say, or you had a part in the creation of a song.
Mm-hmm. What year was that Shrek 2 came out?
I think it was in 2004.
Uh-huh. Okay.
In fact, we knew we were going to go to the Oscars, and I still left the band. They played the Oscars in February of 2005.
Uh-huh.
And that was another thing. I just had enough of Hollywood, you know. It's strange to say, but even the manager had called me at, like in February. Said, "Matt, do you want seats? You know, we'll send a limo. You and your wife can go." I said, "You know, I'd rather watch it on TV. I'd rather watch it with my boys on my lap and watch it on TV." So I watched the guys play at the Oscars. You know.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it. You know, I enjoyed being. I enjoyed Prince. Saying my name. That was the highlight of my year. I called the drummer Jim, and we were going, "Say my name, Prince. Say my name."
That's so funny. Awesome. You should get a little sound bite of that. And
yeah, good idea. Very good.
Well, now that the Counting Crows have, you know, left their label, they made big news about that a couple weeks back. What do you think they'll do with their career? I'm just kind of curious with your insider info, if you think they'll go on to be somewhat of an innovator like the Nine Inch Nails, Trent Reznor, and what that whole crew's been up to, or if they'll just, you know, stick to the standard model but just get their own distribution and basically run their own label. Just curious.
Good question. I have no idea what their plans are, but their manager is a powerhouse named Gary Gersh, and Gary was the guy who signed Nirvana, and he went to become the president of Capitol Records. So he's the one that got us into the Oscars, I'm sure of it. He knew that the Shrek 2 people and got us all to write the song for Shrek. So Gary's the innovative business guy behind that band, and I bet he's got something up his sleeve.
Mm-hmm. You
know. I should find out what they're up to, actually. I got to call the drummer.
Is he your inside connection?
Yeah, Jim's my spy. You know. I mean, we're all friends, actually, but, you know, I like to talk to Jim. We were actually best mates in the band.
Yeah, yeah. Well, cool. Well, what's next on the horizon for you musically? You've got your solo album out. Any other albums on the works or collaborations going?
Well, interestingly, I'm into Indian music, and I know that's the Western ear doesn't relate well to Indian music. It sounds like background music in a restaurant, you know, to us when we're having Indian food. But I'm a big fan of Indian music, and so I just made a Qawwali CD that I just got a few printed, and it's, I don't know what to do with it yet. And so I'm just going to talk to, you know, a couple of friends in the business and see what they can do, because I want to take this band. Qawwali music is a really aggressive vocal style of Indian music,
mm-hmm.
and I'd love to take this little band out on the road. So I made the CD without the thought of like selling records. I want it to be like a business card to get out there live.
Uh-huh.
And so that's my next plan here. I want to take my little Qawwali band out. It's a bunch of Indian guys, dear friends of mine. This one guy named is Nitin Haldonkar. He's from Ohio, and he's a great singer. And so if we can shorten the distance between us here and get some rehearsals in, you know, I want to take us live. And book it as Counting Crows, ex-bass player, and then Jaws are going to drop, because I'm just going to walk out there, and we're going to all play Indian music. It's going to be awesome.
That's great. So yeah. You mentioned, you know, that this form of music, you want it to be more of a live experience than just the album to be just sort of the business card. Is that something that you think is due to just where the business is, or is that something that you think is more genre-specific?
Genre specific, definitely. I don't see this record selling a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really specifically made as a way to get us heard and as a hard copy into the hands of promoters. And I just want us to do festivals and stuff like that. Yeah, that's my plan. And then another record with a Grammy winning Indian slag guitar player, a guy named Vishwa Mohan Bhatt. And so I put bass all over his recordings recently. And so I got a couple of world music labels interested, so I'm kind of looking at that route for that recording. But, you know, for my solo record and my second solo record, I'm going to be doing it all through CD Baby. I'm just, you know, my songwriter's records.
Yeah, you know. Yeah. Well, you mentioned the kind of music, you know, you're doing that Indian music not being a big seller, but you'd be surprised how much of that kind of stuff we sell through CD Baby. And that's one of the things that I've thoroughly enjoyed working here, that you see so many things that'll never, you know, show up on the map as far as mainstream, especially U.S. culture, but, you know, they have their audience worldwide, and we're able to help facilitate that. So don't sell yourself short.
Yeah, thank you very much. I might be talking to you guys then about this other one, but good to know.
Well, do you have any advice for any artists that are up and coming that that you would like to impart before we close out the podcast?
Well, you know, Elvis Presley's bass player is a guy who gave me some of the best advice of my life. He played bass with Elvis Costello and Elvis Presley, and he said, "Matt, write songs." That was all he said. This is the best advice you're ever going to get. Start writing songs. And Jerry Sheff. Yeah, that was his name, Jerry Sheff. And it was back in 94, and Jerry lent me his bass to record something on a song on Recovering the Satellites, a song called Miller's Angels, and that was Jerry Sheff's bass I played. And he said, "Matt, write. Just start writing." So, you know, it's all about the songwriter. Everybody else is supporting the songwriter, you know, and in this business, it's the songwriter that gets the respect.
Yeah.
So that's my advice. My advice to everybody, write songs.
All right. Well, we'll leave it on that. Thanks for taking time to talk, Matt.
My pleasure.
Thanks again to Matt Malley for taking time to share his experiences with us. You can tell that even with the success he's seen, at the center of everything he does is his artistic heart. If you'd like to weigh in on the podcast or any previous episode, there are several ways you can do so. One is our listener line at 206-426-5683. You can email us at info@cdbabypodcast.com, or you can leave a comment on the show notes for this episode, which are located at the podcast website, which is cdbabypodcast.com. Well, we'll catch you next time. Bye. You've been listening to the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, USA.